welcome to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. This is Adrian Tuttenham, and I'm going to be your guide as we ramble through a miscellany of sounds from the forgotten past. We're going to begin the programme by going back to March of 1925. A new musical called Rose Marie, with music by Rudolf Frimmel and Herbert Stothert, had just opened in Drury Lane Theatre. With an 80-strong chorus and full of memorable songs, it was guaranteed to be an instant hit, and it remained immensely popular for another 50 years. The tunes were also adapted and played for dancing by all the popular dance bands. Here is the Savoy Orpheans, recorded in the Savoy Hotel, London, playing Totem Tom Tom Foxtrot. The Savoy Orpheans playing Totem Tom Tom Foxtrot from Rose Marie. Gracie Field's voice remained one of the most distinctive in show business throughout her career, but her style changed over the years. Her post-war recordings were generally sentimental songs, with a few old favourites thrown in, but in the 1930s she was primarily a comedienne. The humour of her songs was gentle, and came from exaggerating small everyday occurrences which were familiar to her audiences. Many of her recorded songs were innocent enough, but occasionally she delighted audiences by hinting at the bawdier side of life, although always in a completely inoffensive way. Here she is, in 1930, singing about something so trivial you could hardly believe it was worthy of a song, The Little Puddin' Basin.
Auntie Flo was wealthy, cause she'd always practiced thrift, and when she died she left her relatives a little gift. Our cousin Joe, her favourite, had one all to himself. 'Twas the little pudding basin that stood on her kitchen shelf. Oh, the little pudding basin that belonged to Auntie Flo. It's very much admired, but it's quite a curio. When he's asked for a reference, well, all he has to show is the little pudding basin that belonged to Auntie Flo. The day he married Herman Trudy was a swell affair. The Boy Scouts came in dozens, the police were also there. They didn't have a cake, but on the table was displayed a steak and kidney pudding that his Herman Trudy had made. In the little pudding basin that belonged to Auntie Flo, we had our photos taken as we stood there in a row. We ran short of confetti and had nothing else to throw. So we threw the pudding basin that belonged to Auntie Flo. They thought they'd go to Paris for a quiet honeymoon, for no one is surprised there when they see young couple spoon. They got aboard the steamer in a happy frame of mind, when Herman Trude said, "Stop that boat, I've left something behind." It's the little pudding basin that belonged to Auntie Flo. The boat began to rock and all the sailors said, "Heave-ho!" Then Herman Trude cried, "Steward!" And he came up from below with the little pudding basin that belonged to Auntie Flo. They've settled down at Brixton, but a flat was hard to find. At last they got a bedroom, parlour, kitchen all combined. They bought some lovely furniture, gave £2 for the lot, and standing on the dresser is the nicest thing they've got. It's the little pudding basin that belonged to Auntie Flo. They've everything for comfort there, or very nearly so. They haven't got a bathroom, but they don't mind that, you know. For they use the pudding basin that belonged to Auntie Flo. That pudding basin is coming for some things.
Gracie Fields singing Little Puddin' Basin in May of 1930. You're listening to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. One of the stranger makes of record which turns up in junk shops and at record fairs is the Aerial Grand Record. You never quite know what you're going to get on an aerial. It could be a first-class recording of a performance by a top singer using a pseudonym, or it could be an appallingly bad recording of a load of unbearable rubbish. The explanation for this lies in the tallyman system of door-to-door selling and the fact that the aerial company never actually made any records. In the 1920s, mass-produced gramophones were becoming so cheap to make that the mail-order company, J.G. Graves of Sheffield, hit upon the idea of giving them away and making their money from selling the records to go with them. The average working-class family in those days couldn't afford to pay out a lump sum, so they signed an agreement to buy a certain number of records over a period of time in exchange for the free gramophone. Each week, Graves sent around a tally man to collect the payments and deliver the records. Naturally, the large, prestigious record companies couldn't risk tarnishing their names by association with such a venture. But equally, they couldn't afford to let trade like this slip through their fingers. So they worked out a way of selling records to the Graves concern without the connection becoming obvious. In the factory, at the end of the pressing run, when the record stampers were beginning to get a bit worn and the quality was starting to fall, they would stop using their own labels and press off a few dozen extra records with aerial labels instead. Nowadays, the slightly substandard presswork is quite unnoticeable after a further 80 years of wear and tear. That was the reason Graves' aerial records were so variable. They came from many different companies and all sorts of possibly worn-out stampers. Tracking down their origins can be a fascinating exercise. Even though the labels and performers' names deliberately offer no clues, the manufacturer's matrix numbers in the record surface are quite distinctive and give the game away immediately. This next record is an aerial made in the late 1920s, or even the early 1930s, But the matrix is the number 8815 followed by a lowercase e. This was HMV's letter code for their recording engineer, Will Gaisberg. And Peter Copeland's dating table shows that it was actually recorded in July of 1908. During the intervening years, many, many stampers must have been made from the original metal mother, and the stamper code on this disc is OD, which translates as number 50. Obviously, it had been a really popular record. The label gives the tune as Laughing Water, which is probably correct, but the performer is named as James Kirk. This turns out not to be a time traveller from a film about space exploration, but is almost certainly another pseudonym for our old friend Billy Whitlock. So here is an aerial record, which is probably an HMV, with probably Billy Whitlock playing probably his own composition, Laughing Water. Laughing Water, played by James Kirk, which was probably a pseudonym for Billy Whitlock. It's a long time since we heard from one of the best-known singing duos of the 1930s. One of the pair was B.C. Hilliam, an Englishman who had spent his early life in Canada. The other was Malcolm McKechan, an Australian who spent his working life in England. Together they were known as Flotsam and Jetsam. And here they are to tell us the story of Schubert's Toy Shop.
So far away in a small town in Germany, a man keeps a toy shop and Schubert is his name. He sells every make of toy, girl or boy would enjoy, every kind of child's decoy, every sort of game. out had long been regarded as a crazy man. Ever since somebody passed around the word that he had told his poor old wife that his toys came to life every day at 5:30, which was quite absurd.
Trading had to stop and Schubert closed his tiny shop. Well, then came the time when those toys of his came off the shelves. Then came the time when they started to enjoy themselves. At least that's what Mr. Schubert still would have us to believe.
Out of their boxes came all the little soldier toys. From cardboard houses came dolls of every clime. Many's the soldier's heart beats fast when their man's marching past. Toys may be on metal cast, the toys are on parade.
Stand so tiptoe, peep through a hole in the shade. Can you see through to right of, and don't be afraid.
Now, friend, pretend, just for poor old Schubert's sake, you hear the drum and fife, and let the old man think his toys have really come to life.
It's sad he had all of his boys in the war, each one passed on and ne'er to return anymore.
Poor, sad, half-mad Schubert declares that his boys come there from somewhere to join the parade of the toys.
Don't let him see tears a-standing in your eyes. Toy guns, dead sons, haunt him till he dies.
So that's why old Schubert was known as a crazy man. Ever since somebody passed around the word that he had told his poor old wife that his toys came to life.
Every day at 5:30, marshals tried to rum and fight.
Dull spectators, men and guns ordered around by his sons.
Boys beloved and once caressed, now twice blessed, now gone west.
Sons he'll never see again.
Poor old brain, half insane, leave him.
His boys, leave him. His boys. That is the story of Schubert's Marshmallow.
Flotsam and Jetsam singing Schubert's Toy Shop. You're listening to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. Our final record for today is a play. By the time this record was made, plays had been specially written for films for over 30 years, and for radio broadcasting for nearly 10 years. It was only another 4 years before they were being written for television too. Strangely, there were hardly any plays written for gramophone records, and those that were didn't seem to sell particularly well. The example we're about to hear may go some way towards explaining this. This is going to be our last record for today, so this is Adrian Tuddenham thanking you for listening and looking forward to your company again next week. In the meantime, let's go back to 1932 and listen to The Living Death by Mildred J. Atkinson.
This sketch, The Living Death by Mildred J. Atkinson, is the outcome of a recent competition for thrillers written specially for gramophone records. The scene is laid in Professor Gregson's laboratory.
My God, I've done it. Rufus Sewell, lad, it's a miracle. Marjorie! Marjorie! Down, Rufus! Quiet! I hear voices. Who can it be? It's Stevens again. I warned the scoundrel not to come here anymore. And Marjorie, well, we shall see. Marjorie! Marjorie!
Yes, dear?
The experiment is a success. I've taken Rufus out of the ice chamber, and he's alive. But is there someone with you? I thought I heard voices.
No, dear, of course not. Oh, I'm so glad it's a success, Tom. Dear old Rufus. And is he really all right?
As well as the day I put him in. Look at him. Marjorie, this simply revolutionizes science.
But how can that be?
Why, by means of that little chamber you see there with the iron door and with the refrigerating plant, I can suspend the action of the heart indefinitely. Then, by raising the temperature in the chamber, and with this tube which I insert in a vein, I set the heart in motion again.
Tom! And is Rufus no worse for his experience?
Not a bit. Merely the action of the heart has been suspended. Rufus has been in there dead for a month. But it could have been a year or 100 years.
Oh, how wonderful! But it's not cold in there now, Tom.
No, you see, I had to switch off the motor before I went in for Rufus. And it's the motor that drives the refrigerating plant.
Oh, I see. But can you...
What is that?
Oh, I don't know. I'll go and see.
No, I'd better go.
No, I'll go.
But it may be... Marjorie, is there someone upstairs?
No, of course not.
Quiet!
There is someone in the house. Rufus knows.
No, I'm sure there isn't. Tom, close the door.
There is, and you know it too.
No, let me go. You're hurting me.
Who's up there?
No one.
Don't lie to me. Your face betrays you. Who is up there?
Let me go, I say.
Is it young Stephen?
Oh. Oh, don't look at me like that. Tom, what are you going to do? Oh, please, Tom, listen. He only called to return some books and to hear the results of the experiment. But you seem to hate him, so I didn't like to tell you. Oh, Tom, speak to me.
Interested in the experiment, is he?
Yes. Shall I go and tell him it's been successful?
No, I don't think we will tell him. Just yet.
Tom, what are you going to do? Oh, you frighten me.
You remember what I told you the ice chamber did?
Yes.
Come.
Ow! Not to me!
Yes, my dear, to you. Why, surely you're not frightened. Can't a man experiment on his own wife?
Oh! Quiet!
Oh! If you scream again, I'll silence you forever. And that will be worse than an hour or two in the ice chamber.
I'm just going to put this friend of yours through a little test.
No! No! I won't go! You shan't do it! Help!
Marjorie, what's the matter?
Come in. Well, Stevens, what do you want?
Where's Marjorie? I thought I heard her call me.
You thought you heard my wife call you?
Yes.
I think you must have been mistaken, young man.
But where is she? What is that door over there?
That is the ice chamber. Would you like to look inside? Come here. Just lift this steel plate that covers the inspection glass. So.
Oh.
Now, what do you see?
Good heavens, Marjorie. You fiend. What are you doing? Are you mad? Is she dead?
Calm yourself. It's merely suspended animation.
You devil. That's what you did to the dog. Get her out. Marjorie!
Call away, my dear sir. She can't hear you. She's dead to you.
But you can't mean to let her die. What's she done? Get her out at once, I say. My God, if only I could open this cursed door.
You're wasting your strength, my friend. Only I can get her out of there with a beating heart.
Then, for heaven's sake, get her out. Why are you torturing me like this?
Because I have not yet decided whether I want her to come out. And I don't intend that she shall come out to you.
You maniac. If you don't get her out at once, I'll go for the police.
Don't think you will. The police could not get Marjorie out if I wished it otherwise. I will settle this matter. Care for a drink, Stevens? I have all the necessaries down here.
Your next drink will be in hell if you don't get Marjorie out of there. Oh, that cursed motor's driving me mad. For heaven's sake, man, do something!
You would not drink with me, and I don't blame you. It was hardly the elixir of life.
You fool, what have you drunk? Where's that bottle? Prussic acid. He is mad. What shall I do? Oh, for mercy's sake, stop that confounded motor. Get Marjorie out of there quickly if you want to save your soul. You haven't long. Hurry! Oh, tell me what to do.
Why should I bring her back? She is beyond your reach. And in a few moments, I shall be gone too.
Don't waste any more precious time. Tell me what...
Do you love her?
What does it matter? Only bring her back to life.
Listen carefully to my instructions. You see that... that knob on the right-hand side of the door?
Yes, yes.
Turn it to the left and pull out the plug just below it.
Oh, that's better.
Pull down that lever over the door and I'll look through the inspection window. Is it slightly misty?
Yes, yes.
There is the key. Go in and pick her up. Take her up tenderly. Lift her with care. That's right. Have you got her safe? Then keep her like that. Whatever.
Stop. Stop. Don't shut that door. Help. Help.